A Bug's Life with Theo Evans.
Theo Evans is back. It's A Bug's Life. Theo is Associate Professor of Applied Entomology at the University of Western Australia. And Theo, fleas. About time you brought us some fleas.
Hi, Suzanne. Well, you know, I do aim to bring blood-sucking pests into everybody's lives.
Now, they're important, but mostly in bad ways, fleas. Am I right?
That's right. You'd be hard-pressed to find people who think fleas are a good thing.
They are quite common culturally, aren't they, though? Flea circuses.
Yes, there's a few interesting cultural references to fleas that are not related to their blood-sucking ways. And I think that's kind of a fun, a different side of fleas that we've mostly forgotten about today.
What is a flea circus anyway?
Oh, so a flea circus is a sideshow kind of an act. They were common for about 300, 400 years from the 1500s, the Middle Ages, and they ran up until the early decades of the 20th century. And a flea circus used fleas to power mostly metal, but sometimes wood and cloth, toy-like structures like carts or carriages, or after Henry Ford came along, you know, model little cars. Because fleas are incredibly strong for their size, you could sort of hide a flea inside these little toys, and these toys would all kind of move around, and you couldn't see what was making them move.
You're kidding. So, fleas are that strong.
Yes. So it's mostly because they've got this special protein in their exoskeletons, the shell around the animal, called resilin. And so they'd use their muscle to deform their exoskeleton, and that stores a huge amount of elastic energy. And when they let go, the exoskeleton snaps back to its shape and it releases this huge amount of energy extremely quickly. And that's why a flea can jump extraordinary distances given how tiny they are. And so they can use that to power these little toy cars and whatnot.
Wow. All right. Maybe we need to employ them in some way with the, you know, the energy challenges of the 21st century. Anyway, where do fleas come from originally? What's their backstory, Theo?
So fleas are an odd group of insects. Most people might just think of them along with lice and bed bugs and other blood-sucking things. They all evolved their blood-sucking behaviour quite separately, though. Fleas belong to the order Siphonaptera. And that comes from siphon and aptera. And siphon is a tube or a pipe, and that refers to their mouth parts adapted to sucking blood. And aptera means wingless in Greek. And the winglessness is kind of odd. People for many years didn't actually know what other insects fleas were closely related to. And eventually we figured out it was this little order called Micoptera, or better known as scorpion flies. Now, most people probably don't know about scorpion flies because they are not common and they are not diverse. They're called scorpion flies because the male scorpion fly has these bizarre genitals that curve up and over their bodies, and they look something like the tail and sting of a scorpion. So they look scary and nasty, but they're only really worrying if you are a disinterested female scorpion fly. And scorpion flies have lives that are quite different from that of a flea. They've got wiggly grub-like larvae that mostly eat plant matter, often dead, decaying plant matter, but the adults are carnivorous. But they can catch and kill smaller insects if they fly around on the wing, but mostly they've evolved this habit of sneaking onto spider webs and stealing the dead insects the spider caught and wrapped up in silk and is waiting to eat sometime later on.
Oh, that's clever.
It's very clever. I mean, you have to avoid being eaten by the spider yourself, but if you can avoid that, you've got lunch on a plate, so to speak. There is a clue, though, in the shape of the mouth parts of the scorpion fly. They are kind of long and thin. They have a beak-like shape on their mouth parts, but they're chewing mouth parts, but it's only the very end of this long beak which is adapted for chewing. And we've figured out that what they do is they get their food, usually this stolen dead insect from a spider's web, and they kind of chew it up using these little tiny mouth parts at the end of their rostrum and spit out saliva to make it into a mushy liquid, and then they suck it up. And so we can see the beginning of that tube-sucking mouth part of a flea when we look into these weird jaws of the scorpion fly.
Right. So did the flea then kind of break off from the scorpion fly then in its evolution?
They did. About 160 million years ago, so this is when dinosaurs were around, and we actually have nothing in between. We have no fossils and no relictual still living species that are sort of intermediate between a scorpion fly and a flea. You know, most of this evidence that fleas evolved out of scorpion flies comes from DNA studies. So sometime back 160 million years or so ago, we did have mammals. They weren't common. They were small. They usually ran away and hid from dinosaurs because they were kind of a tasty snack for dinosaurs at the time. And so we guess at some point there was a weird group of scorpion flies that started chewing on those ancient mammals, and they split away, and it must have happened pretty quickly. And we all think this happened in Gondwanaland, the old ancient supercontinent of all the southern continents of the world, like Australia, Africa, South America, Antarctica, and so on. And they really latched onto mammals as warm-blooded animals. And today we've got a couple of thousand flea species, and almost all of them, 95, 98%, something like that, bite mammals. But a few did switch onto birds. Remember, birds are warm-blooded as well. And we think birds came second, partly because so few fleas have evolved to attack birds, but mostly because all of their close relatives also bite mammals. And so we saw this when we talked about bed bugs. Bed bugs evolved probably to attack feathery dinosaurs, and then they switched onto birds, and then they switched onto other mammals, most importantly bats. So same kind of pattern, but reversed.
Okay. Now, the thing with the bed bugs is they don't actually feed on us humans. Instead, well, they do, but what they like to do is they like to nest near where we are. They don't actually live on us. But do fleas want to actually live on their host?
Only as adults.
Oh.
So fleas have these wiggly, grub-like babies, the juveniles. So that's like the scorpion fly. Scorpion flies have these wiggly, grub-like larvae that basically eat decaying vegetation.
How big are they, Theo? I picture a flea as being really tiny. So would this larvae be very, very small?
Exactly. Very, very small. So the biggest fleas are only around 3 or 4 millimetres long. Most of the fleas are actually only about 1.5 to 2 millimetres long. And their eggs are really tiny. So the first babies, when they hatch out of eggs, are like 0.5 millimetre or so. And these baby fleas, these larval fleas, are a bit like scorpion fly larvae. They're wiggly, grub-like larvae, and they don't live on the host at all. They actually live around the nesting places of where their hosts live and sleep. The female flea will live on the host. They live on the hosts permanently. They only leave the host to jump from one host to another host. And she'll lay her eggs on the host, but she doesn't have any special way to anchor the egg to the host. So she lays the eggs and they just kind of fall off the host. And hopefully this is happening where the host is sleeping in a nest of some kind, and the egg falls on the ground at the nesting site, and then they hatch, and then these little tiny, tiny larvae then go looking for kind of decomposing bits of organic matter to eat. And that can be anything from the feces of the host to the nesting material that's decaying. So it's usually vegetation, some kind of vegetation that's breaking up and getting fungus and bacteria decaying it around. It can be skin that's fallen off the host. Any kind of detritus like that is what the baby flea eats, and it never gets on the host. It only lives around the nest.
So at what point does it graduate to actually living on the host then?
So once they molt and go through metamorphosis, so they go through a pupal phase and then they emerge as an adult flea and then they have to jump onto the host to get a blood meal.
Okay. So there are some tips there, though, aren't they? If you're trying to keep fleas off your dog or cat, then you want to make sure where they're living is very clean.
That's exactly right. So, if, you know, most people who have dogs and cats as pets, they will have a bed of some kind that the pet will sleep on. And if they get fleas, that is the most likely place that the eggs fall and where the baby larval fleas live. And so you have to clean this bedding material regularly. So hoover everything up, occasionally put them in the wash, a hot wash better, because heat will kill eggs and larvae. And people who feed their animals dry kibble, for example, the dry pet food, we've shown in lab tests that flea babies can grow up to adulthood eating nothing but dog food, dry kibble, or cat food, dried kibble. So you want to make sure that you put that food down only for a short period of time and pick it up. Don't leave it there all day. And if your dog or cat's a bit messy and they spill the kibble, clean it up.
Theo Evans is here. Dr. Theo Evans, Associate Professor of Applied Entomology at the University of Western Australia. It is A Bug's Life. You're with Suzanne Hill on Nightlife. We're talking fleas. Gosh, we've gone through all the best insects, haven't we? Now, this is great. So when it's well known, Theo, that say, you know, a group of women move into a house together, their reproductive cycles, their menstrual cycles will eventually sync. And fleas do this with when they're living on another animal. This is amazing.
Yes, because they're eating the blood of that host animal, they're not just getting the red blood cells and the white blood cells and so forth. They're also picking up hormones that the host animal makes that controls the physiology of the whole host animal. And if you're a female flea that's living on a female host, you and all mammals go through an estrus cycle when they're going to reproduce. Just as human females have an estrus cycle, so do all the other mammals. And fleas have evolved closely with their host. So most fleas like to live on only one species of mammal or a few that are very closely related. Most of the bad fleas, the ones that cause all sorts of diseases, which I guess we'll talk about soon, they might jump around between different hosts. But the majority of fleas like living on just one or a couple of very close species. And they tune into the hormones of that host, especially if it's a female. So when the female mammal host is coming into estrus, she's going to get pregnant. That changes her hormones. And when the fleas bite and take a blood meal, they can detect the change in hormone and that turns on the reproductive cycle of the flea. So that means when the female host mammal, say your pet dog, has puppies, it means the flea is laying eggs so that when the puppies have grown a little bit, those larval fleas will be turning into adult fleas and there will be new hosts for them to jump
perfectly
on.
Timed.
Oh, perfectly timed.
So now we think of fleas living on dogs and cats. Do fleas actually live on humans?
We actually do have a human flea. We call it the human flea, but we also get bitten by other species of fleas that like living on our livestock, such as pets and cattle and sheep and goats and so forth, and also our pests. So ever since humans became agricultural and storing grain and living in cities, a whole bunch of different rodents have decided that they're quite living with us in our cities as well. And several fleas live on rodents, and some of those species of rodent fleas will jump on and feed from humans as well.
So are reproductive cycles ever actually in sync with a flea? I guess that's a bit of a bigger kind of cycle to have to deal with.
It is. So if so, generalist fleas are less well tuned into their hosts because they might bite so many different hosts and the hormones are different between those different host species. So I can't answer for certain if they are tuned into human hormones.
Wow. Hopefully, yes, we're pretty good at getting rid of any fleas that might want to try and live on us.
Anyway. Yes.
Now, there, of course, fleas get a pretty bad rap because of their role as vectors of disease. And one of the most famous examples, of course, is the bubonic plague.
The bubonic plague, Yersinia pestis, is a bacterium. I'll say Yersinia when I'm referring to the bacterium itself. It's what causes the disease, the bubonic plague, which is also known as the Black Death. Now, Yersinia, that bacterium, mostly lives in rodents, a whole range of rodents, but especially the brown or sewer rat, which is called Rattus norvegicus. And we have those in Australia. They're everywhere around the world. They're one of the most common pests, rodents that live in cities. And there are four species of flea that like living on the brown rat. And some of them can jump across and bite humans. And when this happens, if the rat that the fleas were living on has Yersinia living in it, they can transmit Yersinia into people, and that's how people get Yersinia, gets the bubonic plague. And it's probably good to explain why it's called the bubonic plague. I mean, I didn't know this when I was younger, and I had to sort of figure this out when I got interested in medical entomology. It's called the bubonic plague because Yersinia lives in our bloodstream, especially in our lymph vessels and our lymph nodes. And our lymph nodes actually evolve as a way of fighting disease. It's where our immune system likes to congregate, and it will inspect the lymph fluid, which is the sort of plasma of the blood without the cells, the red blood cells and the white blood cells. And these are like staging posts that the plasma goes through, and the various immune system cells can inspect it to look for nasty bacteria and viruses and attack it. So Yersinia gets into these lymph nodes, and it causes them to, it infects them. It actually attacks that part of our immune system, and it causes them to swell and get really painful. And the Greek for groin is bubo. And we have really big lymph nodes in our groin. And so people who got Yersinia and started to get the infection in their lymph nodes, these lymph nodes in their groin would swell up into great kind of balloon lumps sticking out from their groin. And that's how we get the name bubonic plague, meaning groin plague.
Lovely. Just lovely. Okay, so what might have sparked, Theo, at the various times when bubonic plague did break out? What was going on in the rat or the flea population that caused that to happen at those moments?
So Yersinia lives in those rodents, especially brown rats. But
so,
it's not.
So if we have those rats in Australia today, they're running around with Yersinia in them.
They may do, but it wouldn't be common. In Australia, We are pretty good at controlling our rats, and so we have had bubonic plague killing people in Australia in the past, but I couldn't tell you the last time this happened. It was some time ago because it's under pretty good control. So Yersinia does kill the rats too. So it's not like the rats carry the bacterium, Yersinia, and have lovely lives even though they've got this disease. No, they die as well. So if there is a really big outbreak of Yersinia in the rat population, it'll end up destroying the rat population. And so then the fleas don't have any rats to eat. So then they'll leap away from the dead bodies of the rats, and they'll go looking for a new host. And because these rats like living in human houses, what's the most likely thing they're going to find to eat? It's us. And so all the rat population collapses, all the fleas then go looking for humans to eat instead, and that's when they of course, they've all got Yersinia because there's a huge amount of Yersinia because that's what killed all the rats. And so then it all hits the people, and we are very susceptible to Yersinia. So bubonic plague, when you get an outbreak, typically kills about one-third to one-half of the population. And under some circumstances in history, there is reasonably good evidence to suggest it might have killed up to 80% of the people in particular towns. So it's a hugely devastating disease.
Okay, so dead rats would be your first sign, perhaps, that there's something going on, because then you've got to watch out for the hungry fleas. But you say, Theo, that this means that fleas have probably had a greater impact on human health than any other group of insects.
So think of that death rate. You know, one third to one half is the typical death rate when there is a plague outbreak. So when we think about all the other insects that can harm humans, including mosquitoes with malaria and dengue and yellow fever and the like, their death rates are nowhere near that high. And so, and even with lice transmitting typhus, again, those death rates are just not as high. So when you get a half of the population and even more in some cases dying, that has a massive change on the civilization. There's there've been multiple plagues, depending on how you define plague, of course, through human history. One of the oldest was called the Neolithic bubonic plague. So this happened in Eastern Europe in the Neolithic period. So this is when people were still using stone tools, and the human population had really built. This is kind of in Poland and Western Russia, and there was a blossoming of people in that part of Europe at that time, and all sorts of artifacts made of stone tools and what have you, and then suddenly it vanished. And we've looked at dead bodies, that you know, bones and so forth from graves, and these people died from bubonic plague. And so we believe this flowering of this group of people, this sort of big increase in civilized agricultural people living in that part of Europe at the time, got destroyed completely by the bubonic plague. And then it was years before people rebuilt and, you know, established a new civilization in that part of Europe.
Wow. So insects have actually been, as you've shown us week after week, so important and intertwined with our history, Theo. And I mean, when we think about the Black Death of the 1300s, which, you know, famously so many people were killed, created great upheaval in Europe. But the reason that the Black Plague was able to be transmitted across the Silk Road was because of the Silk Road, which was because of the silkworm.
That's right. So silkworm came from China, got spread through trade. That's why the Silk Road existed, because silk was such a valuable commodity and it was pretty light, so it was relatively easy to transport. And there was an outbreak of bubonic plague in Mongolia in the 1300s, because there was a lot of people. So China was a wealthy and powerful empire, sort of much bigger and more powerful than any of the countries in Europe. And they had this big trading empire through the Silk Road. But because there were lots of people, big cities, that usually means there's lots of rats. And so it's only a matter of time before Yersinia builds up in that population. And it did. There was an outbreak. Lots of rats died. They moved on to people. Lots of people died. And those traders along the Silk Road moved those fleas and moved the plague from Mongolia, which was part of the Chinese Empire, across and into Europe, and thus the Black Death, where between 30 and 50% of Europeans died.
Okay. So before we let you go, Theo, do you have anything good to say about fleas?
So maybe not fleas in general, but one in particular, and that's to do with myxomatosis. So we all know what a curse the rabbit is in Australia. It's devastated our country, eating grasses and trees, competing with sheep and livestock, so just, you know, negatively impacting the incomes of farmers, but also taking food away from kangaroos and other wildlife. So CSIRO introduced the myxoma virus into Australia in the 1950s as a way to try to control rabbits, but it didn't spread very well, and that's because we didn't have the right flea. We needed the rabbit flea, which only likes eating rabbits, and it is a really good transmitter of the myxoma virus. And so once we introduced the rabbit flea, the death rate from myxoma went up tenfold.
Where did we get the rabbit flea from?
Spain.
Thanks, Spain.
But so the rabbit flea doesn't like biting other animals. It only likes biting rabbits. So this is a really specialised flea, and it was a good thing because it helped spread the virus, and that helped control the rabbit population. So there's the case of a flea that's actually been a good thing for us.
Well, thank you, rabbit flea. Now, Theo, we did talk in the beginning a bit about, I asked about flea circuses. You do have some more information about flea circuses that you want to share with us.
So the flea circus is a remarkable thing. So they became a sideshow attraction in fairs, and people would pay money to watch the fleas perform, pulling these little carriages or cars or something around. But the origin of the flea circus is in advertising. So metal workers became jewellery makers, and jewellery was a very desirable thing. You could pay a lot of money for your jewels themselves, but a lot of it was about the workmanship, the craftsmanship, and very fine and delicate jewellery holding those precious stones was really desired. And so jewellers created flea circuses because they had to make these very tiny little things for the fleas, and that would demonstrate their skill at manipulating fine metal. And so another group of people, watchmakers, got into flea circuses sometimes later. So watchmakers are essentially clockmakers in miniature, and so they wanted to demonstrate to people that they were very skilled metal workers, and they could make extremely small things that could fit on fleas, which would then advertise the quality of the workmanship of their watches. So originally, flea circuses were made by jewellers. Eventually, they got joined by the watchmakers. And then eventually, they got picked up by just everyday people who didn't have those particular skills, and they became the sideshow people. But I do think it's just an amazing thought that back in the medieval period, those metal workers who wanted to advertise their skill, they started flea circuses.
And Theo, thank you once again for another fascinating instalment of A Bug's Life. And look, we are coming to the end of the series. So if people would like to nominate an insect that we haven't yet talked about, now is the time to do it on the SMS 0467 922 702. Theo, we will talk to you again next week.
Thanks very much, Suzanne.
Thank you, Theo. That is Dr. Theo Evans. He's Associate Professor of Applied Entomology at the University of Western Australia.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.